My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Let's talk.
John Brown. The Illustrated Tudor Dictionary, I've been getting that wrong all morning, is unique. For the first time, the Tudor Age has been brought to life in an illustrated dictionary format that is clear and easy to read. It has been compiled and is the brainchild of Simon Sandys Winch. I'm delighted to say that he joins me live on the line now. Simon, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. The Illustrated Tudor Dictionary, is the aim for this to put, if you like, a bit of colour and to prove to people that it's not all just Henry VIII, etc.?
Pretty much. I mean, the idea is to give an overview of the whole Tudor period in a way that people hopefully will find very accessible. You know, I mean, there's a load of books out there about the Tudors and different people and events, but I wanted to just sort of create a big overview, which people will be able to just dip into at any point and think and find out whatever it is they want to find out about. So, you know, someone wants to read about Henry VIII, they just find Henry VIII easily, and there it's all there for them. So, yeah, a big overview to help people.
And I suppose the thing is, it is of the sort of the periods that we have, the Tudors are perhaps more popular than the Georgians or the Stuarts or the Plantagenets. It's almost like a go-to period of history because it is ingrained, if you like, in the English DNA. I mean, you only have to look at the success of things like, you know, the other Boleyn girls to see how it really captures the public's imagination.
Yeah, I know. I know. I think the Tudors, yeah, they've got those huge personalities which have caught people's attention, such as Henry VIII, you know, Elizabeth I, Francis Drake, and all those. I mean, it was a period of massive personalities, but then every period had that. I think also the Tudor Age is such a key time for the development of English history. It was the beginning of the modern age. And you can very much see that. I mean, that's one thing I really noticed when I was doing the book was that I saw how England developed. It came out of the medieval time to a country which we can now more or less start to recognize as a modern state. So it's an important era and one with, you know, quite charismatic personalities.
I suppose, yeah, because if you look at the start of it, it's about the Bosworth Field, isn't it? Presumably, that's the starting point. And from that, from that until James the First of England, James the Sixth of Scotland, you know, it's a quantum leap, isn't it, in terms of advances in basically everything.
Yeah, no, I know it's so important. I mean, it's the start of men of ability replacing nobility in power. So you've actually got people who know what they're doing running the country for the first time. And you've got the development of a middle class, which hadn't really happened, you know, before. And it became a really important part of English society. It became more vocal towards the end of the Tudor times. And then as the Stuart times, this middle class became even more powerful and demanded their democratic rights. And also England started to become a trading nation where lots of, you know, the start of England's colonial empire is the start of a massive trading network. So, you know, foreign goods started coming into the country. So, it was a pivotal moment.
Yeah, I suppose you can look at it because, I mean, the feudal system gets taken out, obviously, during the Tudor times. And, yeah, we look at trade as an important part and the English Navy in a way that perhaps hasn't been seen before. And also the relationships with Europe and the rest of the world aren't sort of solely defined by, you know, marrying off your four-year 3-year-old niece to the Count of Flanders.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, I mean, England started to look overseas. And, you know, at the time when the loss of Calais happened in 1558, it was a huge blow to English prestige because it was the last English possession on the continent. But historians generally recognize now that the loss of Calais was a good thing because England now just turned its attention overseas and just gave up the expensive, hopeless ventures on the continent where they didn't stand a chance of any success. So English Navy, English traders started looking outwards to get the wealth of overseas and create an English empire, as I said.
And also, it also marks out a fascinating time because of the clashes with the English monarchy and the Vatican and the Pope, who is this, you know, and the home of your own empire, et cetera, which is, you know, it's a huge, I don't think we, you know, in the 21st century UK, we realise how big the threat of excommunication had been to all monarchs previous to this. And Henry just goes, well, I'm very sorry, but you know, there's a new sheriff in town, if you like, and you can do what you like. But this is, I'm English, and this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the Reformation was a massive moment, of course. It not just in English history, but European history. And it's all down, you could say, to one woman, Anne Boleyn. I mean, we don't know if she was a Protestant herself. We think she had Protestant leanings, but she inadvertently brought about the Reformation and England becoming a Protestant country. And Henry, you're right, Henry VIII decided he would go it alone, which was very brave.
Yeah.
But he got excommunicated. But he didn't care. He thought, you know, as you say, I'm the sheriff in town.
when it comes to doing something like this, it must be quite difficult to pick out, I suppose, the main point. And another thing I like about is the front cover, because it's kind of got the things that sort of sum up the Tudors. So you've got a bishop's hat, stroke cardinal's hat. You've got a quill. You've got a crown. You've got a sailing galleon. You've got a very nasty looking, I think that's a halberd. Well, I think it's a pint, you know, a pint. Yeah. And you've got the executioner's chopping block. So, I mean, did you have any say that those, if you like, are the six tenets that go behind it?
Yeah. I mean, those were the six things I wanted in it. I mean, they asked me for an original design for the front cover. And what I came up with, probably they thought that's a drawing from a year one child. It was hopeless. What they came up with, it's beautiful. But I had the idea for those six things. But, you know, their design was amazing. And I always think you can judge a book by its cover.
That's very good. Yeah, very good idea. The interesting thing is, but it does point out a couple of bits and pieces, i.e. we talk about, good Queen Bess and all this sort of thing, but, and, you know, Henry VIII, and he's gone in folklore and, in British folklore and Francis Drake. But it is, the art of politics and the art of monarchy are absolutely marked with violence. So if we just look at the halberds, the chopping block and the galleon, I mean, you know, I'm if I get in my car and drive, I could be in Cadiz in 2 hours. And obviously, you know, we refer to Francis Drake as, you know, one of the great English sailors, and of course in Spain they refer to him as a pirate.
Yes, El Draco, I think they called him El Draco. Was it the dragon? And he's supposed to have a magic mirror. The Spanish believed he had a magic mirror, which always gave away the location of their galleons, the Spanish treasure ships.
I hadn't heard that one before, but okay.
Yeah, no, he was the real sort of bogeyman in Spain. And he, as you probably know, raided Cadiz. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think Cadiz was raided at least twice in the Elizabethan time. Drake was the first one, the singeing of the King of Spain's beard. But yeah, he was, you could say, just a pure pirate. I mean, technically, he was a privateer. And which was a bit of a grey area, the difference between those two. But of course, he was a pirate, and he raided the Spanish coastline several times, up especially in the northwest. Several Spanish churches were destroyed, and villages and inhabitants killed. So he was ruthless, and you know his reputation in history, I think, has been burnished more than anybody's. He was not probably a pleasant man. If you came across him, it's not someone you could easily befriend.
Yeah, but the
but
thing,
very yeah, respected.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you grew up in the UK, if you grew up in England in the 50s and 60s, there's always that thing about, you know, him playing bowls, etc. And it all goes back to that sort of that very sort of post Second World War, the Victorian imagining of how history had to be written. I'm just thinking about how you. With something like this, how hard hitting can you be with the actual, with the violence, with the horrible things that went on, with the persecutions? Because we tend to look back at periods of history sometimes with sort of rose colored spectacles, and this in particular, Tudor age is. As people would say, this is England at its best, England at its finest. You know, Elizabeth, you know, the first Elizabethan age, and when the Queen, when our late monarch came in, she said this would be a second Elizabethan age. So, how careful do you have to be to actually say, well, actually, you know, if you were a Catholic or if you were of this minority,
I was as honest as possible. I tried to get through all the Tudor propaganda because there's a lot of Tudor propaganda out there. Yeah, and a lot of it came from Shakespeare's quill, and he in turn got it from Thomas More's quill, who got it from a man called Morton, who worked for Henry VII. But yeah, there's a lot of propaganda, and I just wanted to remove all that and say things like, actually, Drake was a violent, unpleasant piece of work. Actually, Catholics were badly, terribly treated, and little, you know. In fact, not many people know, but when the Spanish Armada was defeated, the vast majority of English Catholics celebrated because they didn't want to be ruled by Spain.
Mm.
They were just as happy. But unfortunately for them, you know, the war with Spain created even more persecution of English Catholics, and they suffered terribly. Having Mary Queen of Scots in the country, of course, didn't help. She was always a beacon for the extremists.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of English Catholics just wanted to live peacefully, be left alone, and be allowed to worship in peace and privately in their own little private chapel. And also the Jesuits who came to England, they weren't trying to, on the whole, they weren't trying to change the state. They were just there to try and help English Catholics to pray, but they got terribly persecuted. It was the most dangerous mission in the world. These Jesuit priests were sent to all parts of the world, India, America, China, but England was regarded as the most dangerous mission because they knew if they got caught, it was not going to be a pleasant end.
That's what I mean. I grew up in the Midlands area, so you know, and would go to sort of, I'm from Staffordshire, but it would go to less, you know, Northamptonshire. What, you know,
that's quite a Catholic area,
exactly. And the thing was, we would always there. We whatever stately home we were being shown around, or I was being dragged along reluctantly as a 7-year-old. It was always, and here is the priest hole, and at the time you think, oh, that's fun, you know, oh, look, a secret passage. And it's only when you look later and you think, my goodness, you know, these you know, priests, Catholic priests, are holed up for literally for days in these tiny spaces, and if they're discovered, you know, they're going to be put to death.
I know. There was a terrible story. I think it was Edmund Campion. He was a Jesuit priest, and he and another priest had to hide in this priest hole below the grate of a fire. There's a fireplace, huge fireplace of this private house. And someone had tipped off the authorities, and they went immediately with soldiers, and they hid below this fireplace. And I think, remember, there's some soldier stirred up the embers, and all these red hot embers came falling down on these priests, on Campion's head. And he was down there for about 2 or 3 days, I think it was. His story is an amazing adventure story. His escape from the Tower of London, and I'm getting mixed up with Gerard. Sorry, another Jesuit priest.
Oh, you know.
But anyway, it's just amazing adventures.
But as well as the sort of the geopolitics, Spanish Armada, the discovery of the potato and coffee, or the caffeine, which for me would obviously be a major plus. I mean, there are some lightheaded ones. I mean, including, you know, this is the female ambassadors in the Tudor times.
That was Catherine of Aragon. It was between marriages after Arthur's death.
Yeah.
And, her father wouldn't let her leave England. And there was a big mess over the dowry as well, because King Henry VII, you know, he wanted all his money from the dowry, and the King of Spain was delaying that. But in the meantime, I think the King of Spain and England allowed her to sort of be an ambassador for Spain and England. Yeah.
And also, there's a couple of a king's head used as a football. Now, come on, I know people probably have finishing their
I'm not sure I can give that secret away.
All right, then they have to. Just, I mean, but when it comes to sort of characters coming in, I mean I mean, apart from a huge, you know, apart from the fashion sense, and I'm obviously campaigning for the return of the ruff. But what there are so many great war comparts because it is the arts, it's the sciences, it is Shakespeare. Is Walsingham presumably gets a turn, I would hope.
Yep. No, Walsingham, as you mentioned him, he was man way ahead of his time in intelligence. I'm talking about spy intelligence. You know, his network. I mean, he worked abroad for a while. He built up this network of spies around Europe. He employed, out of his own pocket, a team of decipherers, people who could decode almost anything. And they were experts at resealing letters. So you know how they had a wax seal? Well, it was very difficult once it was broken to actually recreate the seal. So he had an expert who could do that. But it was said that Walsingham, when the Pope sent a message to the King of Spain, it was said that Walsingham got the message before the King of Spain did. So he was really on top of it. And the Queen, she didn't really like Walsingham much, but she knew that the country needed him. And when Walsingham died, I think it was 1590, the King of Spain, Philip, was told by a letter from the Spanish Armada, Walsingham's just died. There's a lot of sadness over here. And apparently Philip just wrote in the margin of the letter, over there maybe, but not here. He was very relieved.
When you look at this, interesting you bring into Spain, because if when you look at how Tudor England is in this period, and you look at other monarchies, particularly Spain, which is, if you like, I mean, I know that Spain's doing its, it's got its expansion going over, it's doing, you know, the South American thing, shall we call it. But you look on how austere, you know, the Philips are. I mean, you know, Catholic with a capital C, and, you know, and pious to the point of pious, you know, pious to the point of pain, basically. And then you look at the flowering of what's going on. I mean, I know you've still got Cervantes and whatever in the meantime, but it's still, you know, you would rather be perhaps in Tudor England than in what, you know, Spain at this particular period of time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on Spanish history. I know that I'm pretty sure that it was the expulsion of Jews and the Moors from Spain, from what I gather, was in retrospect a big mistake because they contributed a lot to Spanish civilizations and culture. But in England, certainly, the late Renaissance, the Renaissance period in Elizabethan time was a it was a time of English, of blossoming of English culture, the theatre and everything.
Mm, indeed. When you write something like this, when you compile something like this, how difficult is it to actually put a stop on it and not make it, you know, the size of The Complete History of the World, volume 15?
Yeah. Well, that was down to the publishers. They said, right, here's your word limit, mate.
Yeah, I know that, but you could be going, okay, I'm full throw, but I've only just got to sort of 1585 or something, you know what I mean?
Oh, I know, yeah, it's very difficult. And I said in the beginning I had to leave some people out, and I just, you know, I can only apologize for that, because obviously some people have different ideas. Oh, why did he miss out so and so? Why did he miss this out? So, you know, it's purely subjective.
So when it comes to sort of like your top people or your worst people, I mean, who would you say I'll give you two on this one. The people that you think I wouldn't like to bump into them in a dark alley behind, you know, in Cheapside at certain point, and those people you think they were ahead of their time, they were enlightened, they were like good people.
Okay, that's easy. I think the person I'd like to avoid who was really, really unpleasant piece of work, and no historian has ever been able to say a good word about him. I don't know if you can think who this might be. It was Sir Richard Rich.
Right.
Now, have you seen Wolf Hall?
I haven't yet, no, but I've been hearing good things about it. Richard Rich, okay, that's
Richard Rich.
That sounds like some sort of East Side rapper, but anyway, go on.
yeah, he was from Essex.
Okay.
No, no, I mean, where do I start? He would be happily betray and torture ex-friends and colleagues just to work his way up the greasy pole of ambition.
Right. Okay.
Such an unpleasant character. He was one of those who personally tortured a lady called Anne Askew. Now, if you torture, even in those days was frowned upon, and you only allowed torture in extreme circumstances with permission from the monarch or Privy Council. But he personally tortured this lady, this noblewoman, which was unheard of. Just because he wanted to dig the dirt on Catherine Parr,
right,
Henry's last wife. So yeah, he happily betrayed anybody, even including his own religion, just to get up the ladder. And the person I admire the most was probably a man called John Dee. Not many people have heard of him. He was known as the Wizard, and he was a man way ahead of his time. He pushed the boundaries of knowledge. He was the scientific man of Renaissance in England. I mean, most people today would look on him as a complete nutcase. He was into alchemy. He was into cartography, all types of science. He believed he could communicate with angels. But he was constantly... Why not?
Exactly.
He came up with this alphabet, this angel alphabet, which could be used to work out what they're saying. And actually, I always felt very sorry for him because he never got the official position that he craved in order to get financial recompense. He was always short of money. And then once, when touring around Europe, he fell in with a bit of a rogue called Edward Kelly. Edward Kelly?
Yeah.
Yeah. He took him in under his wing, and he convinced Dee that the angels had spoken to him, telling him that they should share everything. And Dee said, "Oh, okay, all right, I believe you." And Kelly said, "Including our wives." And Dee said, "Okay."
Right. Okay.
It was soon after that that Dee and Kelly fell away apart from each other, and Dee returned home and found his library library of amazing scientific instruments had been been ransacked by the local mob because they thought he was a wizard.
Yes.
Incredible story, but he really was an intelligent man.
You see, when you say alchemy and you say Elizabethan age, my default setting is obviously, you know, alchemy and making a lump of purest green from Blackadder. You know, that's you know, the ghost of Edmund Blackadder and Percy strides between. What are you hoping that people are going to take from the Illustrated Tudor Dictionary?
Well, I'm hoping that A, they'll find it really easy to read, and secondly, I think every time they read an entry, my hope was that people come away from that entry, they, "Oh, I didn't realize that. That's interesting." So people might think they know everything, like the Spanish Armada, for instance, but then not realize what was the single most key important factor that made the English ships superior to the Spanish ones. You know, there's all sorts of various bits of trivia I'm hoping people will find interesting amongst the serious stuff.
It sounds like the sort of book that I'm going to go delving into and not come out for at least a week.
Well, it's a whole thing. It's a big trap. The whole thing's a trap.
Set by Walsingham.
Yeah. Because someone once wrote saying, of having read the book, they said they only went to read for one thing, and 2 hours later they realised they'd been trapped and they'd been... Because of the cross-referencing system, they wanted to read about someone else, and then something else, and then someone else. Then they just got lost in the book. So I'm hoping that happens.
Well, if you're going to get lost in any period of time, I think the Tudor period, rather than getting muddled up with the Georgians, is probably much more fun. The book is called The Illustrated Tudor Dictionary. It's by Simon Sandys Winch, and you can order it via our own virtual bookstore. Simon, are you on the Elizabethan the Tudor internet? Do you tweet in Tudor? how can people find you?
I'm on Facebook and Blue Sky.
Ah, marvellous.
Yeah?
Yep. The book is called The Illustrated Tudor Dictionary. It's by Simon Sandys Winch. Go forth and order it and go down the old Tudor rabbit hole. Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you very much.